Welcome back to Search for DOS. In this episode, we meet Judge Roy Altman. Judge Altman was born in Caracas, Venezuela, and immigrated with his family to Miami. After growing up in Miami, he graduated from Columbia University, where he quarterbacked the football team and pitched on the baseball team. Following Columbia, Judge Altman went on to study at Yale Law, where he served as projects editor for the Yale Law Journal. After Yale, Judge Altman went on to serve as a federal prosecutor, twice receiving the Director of the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys Award for Superior Performance. After several years as a partner in a law firm, on April 4, 2019, Judge Altman was confirmed to the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. At 36 years old, Judge Altman became the youngest federal district court judge in the country and the youngest federal judge ever appointed in the Southern District of Florida. In my opinion, you are about to meet a generational mind. Born in 1982, Judge Altman is technically a millennial. But forget millennials. Few boomers or Gen Xers have reached the heights Judge Altman has obtained. To put it into context, in the United States, there are 1.35 million lawyers. And of those lawyers, only 30,000 of them are judges. Of that 30,000, only 870 are Article III judges. This means that after graduating law school, a lawyer has a 0.064% chance of becoming an Article III judge. It isn't an overstatement to say that Judge Altman is one of the most accomplished individuals in America. But this achievement isn't what is most impressive about him. What makes Judge Altman outstanding is his moral leadership. An example of his moral leadership is highlighted in a recent article in Bloomberg. The following is from that article. Florida Southern District Court Judge Roy K. Altman recently returned from a week-long judicial education mission to Israel. He was one of 14 U.S. federal judges who participated in the trip that was led and facilitated by the World Jewish Congress. Sitting federal judges rarely discuss such matters unless they are raised in their courtrooms. Altman has said his comments aren't in his capacity as a judge on the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida or on behalf of the federal judiciary. In an email to Bloomberg Law, Altman said, "When federal judges are sworn in, they didn't give up our First Amendment right to talk about, maybe even shed light on, the important issues of our time." He said that he takes seriously his responsibility to adhere to the judicial canons on ethics and that the perspectives he shared in the pieces were not remotely political or controversial. Altman said in both written pieces he recognized the ugly and monstrous stare of anti-Semitism. Bloomberg goes on to quote Judge Altman saying, "We've seen the dangerous consequences of allowing the moral rot of anti-Semitism to spread through the countryside. I believe that people of good faith, judges or not, have an obligation to shine a light on anti-Semitism whenever and wherever it appears, to speak out forcefully against it, and to make sure that it never again gains a foothold in our society." In my view, Judge Altman is setting the type of example all Americans should follow. He's pursuing an honest and fact-based discussion about the conflict while all the time refusing to cower to the mob of moral relativism. When I think about Judge Altman and his actions after 10/7, I recall a quote from the late Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks as he analyzed Esther's plea. "How can I stand and watch disaster befall my people?" To this, Rabbi Sacks said, "To be moral is to live with and for others, sharing their responsibility, participating in their suffering, protesting their wrongs, arguing their cause." Thankfully, because of Judge Altman, we have one of the great legal minds of the 21st century arguing the cause of Israel, the Jewish people, and all of Western civilization. Thank you. Judge Altman, welcome to Search for DOS.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor to be here.
I'm honored to have you on the podcast. And we first met at an event that you were in conversation with Professor Amar on his book. And I was fired up to be seeing two Yale grads, one who is closer in age that is doing some incredible things in the legal world.
Is that just a way to call Akil old?
Yes, exactly. You definitely were younger than I expected. And that made me that happy. The future is bright. I'd love for you to go back to that event. What was it like speaking with Professor Amar? And what were your takeaways from that conversation?
Well, it was very special. First of all, thank you for having me on. And I'm so glad you're doing this. And it does seem like an important and very needed project. I thought it was so cool. I invited him to come down to the courthouse, the federal courthouse here in Miami, so that I could interview him about his book, which you mentioned, which is actually the first of a trilogy, kind of biography about American constitutional history. And it really is a wonderful book. It's long, but it is well worth the read. And so he had been a professor of mine in law school and has since become a very good friend. And of course, I respect him a great deal. And it was cool because he came to my chambers before the interview, and he came into my office, and you know, I've got all these books here, and so he would point at a book, and he would say, you know, Rousseau and Revolution. Tell me about that book. And of course, love that book, and won the Pulitzer Prize, and we got into a conversation about that. And then he saw the Andrew Roberts Napoleon and Churchill books, and he said, well, what did you think of the George III book? And we talked about that, and then we talked about Chernow and Master of the Senate, and we just had this wonderful conversation that probably would still be going on a year later if my law clerks hadn't said, hey, Judge, it's getting close to about the time when you need to go up to the ceremonial courtroom to interview Professor Amar in front of the crowd. And so we went up there, we had developed a close bond, and I interviewed him in front of what, well, you'll remember, Tyler, was a pretty packed crowd in our courthouse, really a unique event. I don't think we've ever had an event like that in the federal courthouse, having a professor come and be interviewed by one of our judges about a new book. And you know, we had such a great rapport, he and I, and at some point, I think he tried to liken me to George Washington and had me stand up, and I didn't really want to be likened to George Washington. And so everybody was laughing. It was a very funny and I think heartwarming experience, but also, as you mentioned, an intellectually stimulating discussion. You can agree with his view of the Constitution. You can disagree with him, but you can never deny both how brilliant he is and in some respects, how creative he is at finding new solutions to old problems. So I thought it was a wonderful event, and I'm glad you and I got to meet there.
It was a wonderful event, and it was one of those moments where I was just so thankful for Yale. And I often say it's the gift that keeps on giving because it creates opportunities to meet individuals that have minds that are just unbelievably powerful. And I wish I was a fly in the wall as you were working through your library there. You know, you're dealing with a rock star. And to have two of you kind of going back and forth, that's pretty special. I think we could have a whole conversation about your view on constitution law, and we're gonna get into that, but your upbringing is quite unique, especially, I believe, for a federal judge. And I looked into the number of federal judges, and the number that I saw in terms of Article III judges is about 890. Is that correct in the country?
That may include the senior judges as well. That sounds about right. For those of us who are on active status, I think it's probably more like 500, but that may be just an estimate.
Which is pretty wild when you think there's 350 million people in our nation. So I was thinking of that small number, I got to imagine you're the only one born in Caracas, and if not the only one born in Caracas who is Jewish. So you're kind of one of one in terms of that background. How did that shape you?
Well, I'm not the only one born in Venezuela. Actually, I'm the second Venezuelan American federal judge. The first was actually also sits on the same floor as I do in this very courthouse, Fred Moreno. But I am the only Venezuelan Jewish federal judge, I think, in the history of the United States. That's probably safe to say. You know, I think there are lots of ways in which someone's background can influence how they judge. And I don't just mean the decision-making process, because to be honest, the decision-making process, it's not quite scientific, but there is a great deal of science to it. And I don't want to make it sound formulaic, but if you're doing the job the right way, then you're working really hard to make sure that your background, prejudices, your biases, your personal preferences and views really don't bleed into the decision-making process. And we all, I think, spend a great deal of time and introspection trying to make sure that anytime we decide a case, whether it's a big case or a relatively small case, that we're deciding the case only on the facts and the law, and not as a result of the judges or the law clerks' political or personal or ideological preferences. But that being said, there's a lot more, I've come to learn to being a federal judge than just deciding cases and controversies. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You know, when people come into the courtroom for jury service, that is an opportunity for me to influence people in our communities and to turn them into kinds of apostles of democracy. People come in jaded with their own perspective about what the civil or criminal justice system is and whether it's flawed or not. And we have a real opportunity, I think, to shine a light on how special our American democracy really is in that courtroom, and to make people feel it, not just to intellectually grasp that, you know, you have the right to remain silent in this country, or that you have the right to counsel or the right to a jury trial, but to make people feel that the fairness that they get in this community and in this country is just greater than the sum of its parts. You know, all of the many different things that we do during the course of a trial, to be solicitous of their time and their needs, to give them breaks, to tell jokes even, to lighten the mood, even in cases that are relatively dark and serious, go a long way in, I think, making the jurors feel comfortable and feeling, as I said, that they're a part of the solution rather than the problem. And you know, the results have been astounding. I get letters from jurors pretty routinely, long after their jury service is done, telling me how meaningful it was to them. And I make it a point after every trial to go back into the jury room and to shake each and every juror's hand and to give them a certificate that I have composed, thanking them for their performance of an important and solemn duty of their American citizenship. And when I do that, the differences in their affect between when they were selected on the first day of the trial, when they realized they were going to be seated as jurors, and when I looked at their faces and saw on that day one emotion imprinted there, which is always unambiguous terror at the thought of having to sit through this trial, the difference between that look and the look that I see on their faces when I come back days or weeks later into the jury room after they've rendered their verdict of appreciation and gratitude and a true sense of belonging to their community is, to me, quite inspiring. And, you know, it is not uncommon for jurors then to want to talk to me about their experiences in front of the other jurors. So, for example, you mentioned being Venezuelan. I had the foreperson in a long 3-week trial say, when I handed them their certificates, asked me whether it was appropriate for him to say something in front of the other jurors. I said, you can say anything you want, just don't tell me about your deliberations or why you guys came out this way or that in the case. Anything else is fair game, you know? And he said that he was from Venezuela, and that his father and grandfather brought him and his siblings over to this country when they were very young, because they wanted them to live in a free society, and that he kind of always understood that America was better than the life they had left behind in Venezuela, but that it wasn't really until this trial, when he got to see what jury service was like, when he got to carry out and effectuate justice in his community, along with 11 other members of his society, that he really felt a belonging to American culture, that he really understood that there was no other country like it. And he actually teared up and started to choke up and saying that he just so wishes that his father and grandfather, who I guess had passed away, could have met me, a Venezuelan American who also had come at a young age and was presiding over a trial like that. And another one that sticks in my mind is in a different 3-week trial. There was juror number 12 was this Haitian woman who had trouble walking. She had used a walker. And at the end of the trial, same thing. I go back there and talk to them and shake their hands. And as I went to go shake her hand, she said, "I can't shake your hand. I need to stand up." So I said, "You know, ma'am, you don't have to stand up. I know you've had trouble walking throughout the trial." And she said, no, "I need to stand up." And then she stood up and I went to shake her hand and she didn't shake my hand. I thought, oh man, this is awkward. And then she said, "I need to hug you. I can't shake your hand." So I said, that was okay. So she came and gave me a very, very long and warm hug. And then I noticed that she was crying on my shoulder. And she said she'd never experienced anything like this in Haiti, and thinks that probably for most of the people who've ever inhabited the earth, they've never gotten to experience the sense of belonging and inspiration one gets from being the decider of how justice should be carried out in your community. And she said she would take this experience with her until the day she died. So, you know, in some respects, who you are and where you come from could inform all the many different ways in which you interact with the many people, defendants, plaintiffs, lawyers, litigants, jurors, and witnesses who come into the courtroom every day, but who more importantly then leave the courtroom every day and can either talk about our system of justice and our democracy here in America in a way that's positive and in a way that's kind of evangelical, or in a way that's negative and downtrodden. And I think that's a real opportunity for us to influence future outcomes by being optimistic, being positive, and living fairness every moment in the courtroom.
It brings up just such an incredible idea, which is this idea of feeling attached to the nation that you're part of, and feeling through service, through obligation, a closer connection and a higher level of care. As you were sharing that, I thought about this book that was recently written by Richard Haass, The Bill of Obligations, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And his thesis in that book is that a major reason why our nation's ailing is because we've been too focused on this conversation of rights and less on obligations. And I think what I hear you saying, that these are two individuals who were born outside of the U.S. and through this obligation, a requirement to do jury service duty, that they built this just incredible kind of love for what they are now part of. And I mean, that is super powerful. And I'm glad you give when did you start that tradition of giving them the certificate?
At the first trial, I think it's not uncommon for judges to give the certificate. I think it probably is relatively uncommon for federal judges to go back and talk to the jurors in every case after the trial, but I've never missed it, and I never will, because it's one of the most rewarding parts of the job.
Let's talk about the job. At what point did you decide that you wanted to pursue this path?
I think probably I thought to myself at some point while I was a trial lawyer that one day it might be nice to try to have an opportunity to be a judge. I never thought that it would happen. I mean, like you said earlier when you were citing the numbers, it really is like being struck by lightning. I think the math works out. Someone told me on the day I was confirmed, the math turns out that actually you may be more likely to be struck by lightning than to become a federal judge in America today. Whether that's exactly right or not, it is certainly quite a blessing that you have to be, to my mind, very much lucky to get, be in the right place at the right time and things like that. But I certainly never thought that I would have an opportunity to be a federal judge when I was 35 or 36, whatever I was at the time. And I do think that circumstances just played out in certain ways that opened a path for me to be able to serve in this way. And that is how I see it, by the way. I see it really as I think I loved what you said before about obligations and duty. I do see it. I don't see it as a job or as work. I see it as a form, as a kind of way of guiding your life's purpose. And I see it as a form of obligation and service to the country. And I love it for that. I think probably to your point, many of us who were raised a certain way, I don't mean just immigrants, but in a hard scrabble way, I guess you would say, grew to love a sense of duty and obligation. And I always say, you know, that there's nothing like playing sports as a kid to forge the kind of man or woman that you'll become later in life. And I certainly played a lot of sports, and the first thing I think sports give you is discipline. And the second is a sense of duty, not just to the game and to yourself, but to your teammates. And the third, of course, is perseverance. And those are all things that are so important if we're to have a citizenry that truly cares and contributes to the welfare of the country. So that's a long way of answering your question about when I thought that this thing would open up for me. It just happened that in 2017, there were seats that were available on the federal district court here in South Florida where I lived. And I took a chance. Lots and lots of people applied. I was very young. The vast, vast majority of them were state court judges of various levels. And of course, I was not. So I think most people believe that I had very little shot. But again, worked hard, had always treated people with respect and with the dignity that I think they deserved, whether they were on my side or the opposing side. And I tell young lawyers all the time, you never know when your adversary is going to be called upon to give a reference about you. That's not a reason to treat him nicely. But if you didn't want to treat him nicely for all the right reasons, that's just an added incentive. And I was given this incredible opportunity, and I've relished it ever since.
What was the most challenging part of the learning curve for you?
I think at the beginning, the hardest thing is deciding all the time. You know, when you are a lawyer, you think to yourself, well, I could be the judge. You know, I could do it. I know the game. I know the rules quite well. And that's all true. You know the rules and you speak the language. I think it probably would be hard for someone to become a federal judge who hasn't really been steeped in the federal courtroom, you know, the federal courtroom's affect and its unspoken language for many years. But fortunately, I was. So that part wasn't really part of the learning curve. But the first thing that you're struck by is it's really not that easy. As a lawyer, you stand up and you say, well, you should grant my motion, or you should give me an extension, or you should or you should sentence him to 87 months or whatever. And as the judge, you know, you have an obligation to get it right. Whereas as the lawyer, you throw it up there. And then once you give it to the judge as a request, the obligation almost is alleviated. You know, the sense of burden of getting it right lifts from your shoulders and is transferred to his or hers. When you're the judge, all of that weighs on you and you decide all the time. Obviously, you see the decisions that happen in the courtroom during trial, but we're issuing opinions every day, and that's just the scratching the surface. There are hundreds of orders that come out on a daily basis. How much time am I going to give you to file that? Will I give you more time for that? Will I sanction you for this? Will I allow you to use more pages for that? Will I let you appear by Zoom? Will I allow you to file that motion out of time? You know, little things that can have an outsized impact on the direction of any given litigation. And if you get mired, I think, in the difficulty of the decision-making process, then you probably would have a very difficult time with this job. So it's important to be thoughtful, for sure, to be prepared always, but it's equally important at some point to have a reckoning and to just decide and to move the case along. And I think part of the difference between the best judges I've seen and some of the others is a reluctance sometimes to decide difficult questions. So I think that takes getting used to. Another thing, which I wouldn't say takes getting used to or is part of the learning curve, but it is an interesting facet of the job, is, you know, when I went through the process, I did think I had one thing going for me, and that is that, you know, most lawyers, they're either criminal lawyers or they're civil lawyers, but rarely are they both. And I thought, you know, one of the things that that I had going for me was that I'd been a federal prosecutor for almost 7 years, and then I had been a partner at a civil litigation boutique law firm for almost 5 years. And so I thought, you know, that's pretty unique. Maybe that's my angle here. And it's both of those jobs were very much in federal court. So I was part of that culture and spoke that language, which is very different, by the way, than other courts, as you probably know. And so, you know, when I came onto the bench, I was, I think, disappointed to find, but ultimately happy to discover, that I was totally wrong about that, because the fact of the matter is that, yes, I was prepared according to the rules of evidence, of procedure, the unspoken language we've talked about. But the reality is that civil law in federal court, the sort of universe of civil law cases that come before us, is so vast that the kind of civil law I practice, which was mostly MDLs, multi-district litigations, and class actions, big, tort cases and bank fraud conspiracies, airplane crashes, that kind of thing. That's a tiny, tiny 1%, less than 1% of the cases that come onto our docket. And the whole other panoply of them, from antitrust to patent to all kinds of IP law, trade secret, obviously the constitutional docket, pro se cases, statutory claims and commercial disputes, they're so different one from the next. They're as different basically as civil is from criminal. And so one of the things I came to discover, and that I often say is one of my favorite parts of the job, is that if you're an intellectually curious person, and you know, Tyler, that I am, then you're constantly, almost on a daily basis, learning new things, not just about different kinds of industries or different ways in which people's disputes can arise, different ways in which people can get mad at each other and sue one another, but also, and interestingly, different spaces in the law, different kinds of law that, frankly, I had no exposure to before. And that was pretty fascinating too.
To the first part of the learning curve, the I think that's really interesting to focus in on, because you're saying you realize just how much of your life is being spent making decisions. And recently, post 10/7, you made a decision to speak out and be very clear with your language about what was happening in Israel and the war in Gaza. And the universe of people who are smart, in positions that are important or powerful, and are well-versed on these issues is quite small. Many people have decided not to do that. And there are many people who didn't have the potential constraints that you have. So walk us through that decision that you made.
Yeah, well, for me, it came, I think, sort of organically. I didn't actually make a big decision so much as I thought about it and decided that it would be morally inexplicable for me to stay silent. And here, you know, I think background does matter. My grandparents lived in Europe just before or during the Holocaust. They fled the continent for South America and, of course, experienced their own kinds of anti-Semitism, both in Europe and in South America. And then we came here, and then I didn't experience any of that. You know, I have led such a blessed life because we live in a great country that welcomed in this sort of hodgepodge person, Jewish, Venezuelan, half Mexican, whose mom grew up in Colombia. Grandparents are from Romania, but grew up in Czechoslovakia and Poland. My grandmother shot and killed a Nazi who tried to rape her in France. My other grandmother's from Lithuania, but grew up in Mexico. I mean, you know, you try to sort of check boxes for people now about what race and ethnicity they are. I mean, these questions are very complicated when it comes to diaspora Jews, not just me. And to my mind, here was this mutt who came to this country that owed me nothing and has given us everything. And then I grew up hearing the stories of what the Holocaust was like, where it started. It started in schools when kids wouldn't talk to my grandparents, and suddenly they would mock them. And then next thing you know, they were beating them. And of course, now you see it starting in schools again. And so, you know, I was on another podcast recently. By the way, this whole thing of being on podcasts, totally new to me before. And I was asked on the podcast, what would you like to be written on your tombstone? And I thought that was an odd question because I'm 41 and I do eat a lot of kale. So I'm hoping that that doesn't come for a long time. But I think I answered honestly where I said, and I'll tell it to you, that, you know, if this had happened on October 6th, I really just would have wanted that people had said I was a good father and husband and son, that I was a model and decent citizen, and that I was a fair judge who worked hard and treated people with respect. But, you know, after October 7th, I think in addition to those things, I would want people to say that that I stood up for the Jewish people and that I stood up for Western civilization. And I think an surprisingly existential moment in our history. On October 6th, it looked like the Jewish people were living a golden age, and that the West and its influence was almost perennially, almost teleologically expanding all over the world. And now we see that the survival of the Jewish people is yet again in question, that the one Jewish state in the world for which we had fought for 2,000 years is being attacked from all sides, not just militarily or by terrorist organizations, but by seemingly intelligent people on campuses you and I have grown to know and love. The shock and surprise at the moral inversion and the moral confusion and the moral vulnerability that we see all around us is just almost too pathetic for words. And so for someone who had come from that background and who loves this country to have remained silent, I think would have been totally unpardonable. And I'll say one other thing, you know, as a student of history, not on the level of Akhil Amar, but as someone who reads diligently and broadly, I think we have seen that societies that have persecuted Jews, societies that have allowed the moral rot of anti-Semitism to proliferate in their body politics, are societies that are on their way out the window. Look at the Russia of Kishinev in 1903, one of the worst pogroms before the Holocaust of the 20th century. 14 years later, it is gone. In 1917, look at the Germany of Kristallnacht in 1938. It was supposed to be the thousand-year Reich. 7 years later, it was gone. Time and again, we've seen in history that societies that allow the moral decay of anti-Semitism and Jew hatred to start to eat away at the wooden framework of their house are societies that are symptomatic, that they're sick and dying. And so, not because I'm Jewish, but because I'm an American and because I love this country for all the blessings it's given to me, and because I believe it's the greatest force for good the world has ever known, I believe we all have a moral obligation to identify and root out anti-Semitism whenever and wherever it may appear, because it is the canary in our coal mine. And so I've been speaking out, as you say. I basically travel almost every week all over the country, giving speeches at churches and synagogues and community centers, colleges, law schools, now a business school. What do? I tell the story of the Jewish people from Merneptah's Stele in the year 1205 BC all the way until the present day. I describe it in the context of historical fact and international law in a way that I think we judges do on a really routine basis on any number of issues. And I don't find it to be controversial at all. I get that nowadays there's no such thing as truth or reality for many people on these campuses and for many people who support Hamas. There's no other way to put it. That's what they're doing, a terrorist organization. And so to tell the facts about Jews' existence, Jews' governance in the land of Israel for thousands of years seems political, but it's not political. Those are just historical facts. And there's nothing political at all about stating well-researched historical facts. And that's really all I've been doing.
Your example, as I've spent time looking in that universe that is unfortunately quite small, your example is just stands alone. I believe the only way you truly inspire another human being is through action, doing it yourself. And I'm so grateful you're doing this. And I know others will follow. And each talk that you give, be it in a church or a law school, there will be people who will be inspired to do that. So thank you. Now let's start diving into the elements of the how we got to where we're at. And as I was reading up for this episode, I came across a quote, an article in Bloomberg that was talking about you and some other federal judges. And is this quote from Raj Singhal?
Singhal, yeah, he's one of my colleagues on the bench.
Okay. And he said, when people are uncomfortable addressing an important issue, whether in life or in court, often they change the argument to another one so others lose focus. And this is why I think you speaking out is in many ways so much more powerful than any other profile, because you are trained and you are living each and every day weighing the facts and the evidence. Why is that not the norm, especially for people who are, you know, so highly educated? Even if they didn't go the law route, someone who graduates a Harvard or a Columbia should still have that capacity, because clearly that's the best way to go about it. We've structured an entire legal system there in that way. So why are we not there? Why is that not the normal speed, if you will, for your average Ivy League graduate?
Well, I mean, the Ivy League is a tiny fraction of the population. And I think there's some degree what really has happened here is that we've given an outsized influence to the encampment at Columbia, for example, and some of these other schools, because we think, oh, that's the pinnacle of education in the United States. And for a long time it is. But, you know, these places have allowed this moral rot to proliferate on their campuses for many, many years. And you know, as to the question about why we don't see more people standing up, I think first of all, you are seeing people stand up. I think you know, just to look at Columbia University, Shai Davidai, a professor there, has been speaking out. Also, the Jewish students at Columbia University, hundreds of them, signed an unbelievably compelling letter about what their lives on campus were like. It just doesn't get the same media attention as the lunatics, frankly, who took over Hamilton Hall do, or the violators of the code of conduct that built an entire encampment. I guess it was lost on them how ironic it was to protest a so-called occupation in Israel while occupying all of the center of Columbia's campus. But I guess they aren't strong on critical thinking or self-reflection. The other thing, though, I think I should mention is it can be an uncomfortable thing, Tyler. You know, not everyone is built to go out and take a lot of heat, you know, and especially if your business or your social life or your sense of self comes from the relationships that you have and the people that you hope will like and respect you, especially if you're in an industry or in a friend group or social situation where you think those people will, in a manner of speaking, cancel you, shout you down, or shun you even for expressing beliefs that, you know, maybe aren't in conformity with the zeitgeist in that particular social environment or business environment, then, you know, it becomes more difficult, I think, to speak out. You know, there's this notion of moral luck, you know, and in essence, it's basically this. Imagine a person with a particular DNA composition and moral code who's born in Germany in, say, 1920 or 1910, you know. That person will have a very difficult time living a moral life. Not to absolve Nazis of responsibility, but, you know, you grow up in Berlin, you're inculcated with certain views in the 1920s and 30s about Jews, and then there's so much social and then later economic and then finally political and ultimately penal influences on you to conform to the genocidal regime that has taken power in your country. It is going to be hard for you, on pain of death sometimes, to behave in a way that's truly moral. And now compare that person. Imagine that he, the same DNA composition, the same moral code, is born in the same place, the same city and neighborhood and home in Germany. But instead of being born in 1910 or 1920, he's born in 1950. Now it will be relatively easy for him to lead a moral life. There's no Jews around anymore, and what Jews there are, by the time he grows into manhood in 1970 or 80, will be fully integrated and accepted into society. So is one more moral than the other, you know, in this hypothetical situation? I guess we would say that, you know, but in other salient respects, I think we would just have to accept that one had a kind of moral luck on his side of the scales that the other did not. And so, to bring it back to your question, you know, I take the point that it's not an easy thing sometimes to cut against the grain, to say things that the people around you might disagree with, and to take heat for it, you know. But that to my mind is a small price to pay. You know, I'll just give you an example. We just went on a trip to Israel, 14 federal judges from around the country, organized by me and two others, and the World Jewish Congress, who was phenomenal in organizing the trip. And Jewish judges and non-Jewish judges, Republicans, Democrat, people who'd been to Israel before, people who'd never been to Israel before. And it was an incredible trip in a million different ways that we can discuss. But one of the things you should know about is that we went and watched the 47-minute video that Israel has not published to the world. 47-minute video of Hamas atrocities filmed on Hamas GoPro cameras and Hamas phones, a barbarism, an evil that in your darkest nightmare you could never begin to conjure. And you see the last horrifying moments in these people's lives, people who are burned alive, beheaded, tortured. And you think to yourself, if I'm not willing to speak out because I'm afraid of a little bit of heat on the internet from people I've never met before, then who am I? What kind of morality am I living? What kind of life am I leading? What kind of example am I for my children and grandchildren? I'm a nobody. I'm nothing. I'm not worth the robe or the office or even the home I live in. And that's how I feel. So to me, I'm never looking back, because there's right and there's wrong. And Western civilization is right. It has always been. It's made mistakes, but it is the best thing that has ever happened to this planet. And Hamas and its parent company, Iran, and the evil, sinister forces that support them, they are wrong. And know that in this morally relativistic world, it's passe to say that things are right and wrong, but that's just the way I see it. And I want to live a life that I can be proud of, and to have been silent now in the face of growing anti-Semitism and I think unpardonable assault on the one Jewish state in the world, the butchering and slaughtering of innocent civilians, the raping of hundreds of women, the taking hostage of over 240 innocent people who are even now, as we're speaking here today, Tyler, being held in deep, dark, dank holes, hundreds of feet beneath the earth, without food, without medical supplies, without access to a lawyer, it goes without saying, without even sunlight, surveilled by real life monsters for 230 days. No one listening to your podcast could ever begin to imagine what that's like for them or their family members. And if it had happened to the citizens of any other country in the world, including and especially the United States, we would go to every length to bring them home. But only the one Jewish state in the world is prohibited from its lawful right under international law to defend itself and to protect its citizens from terror, from violence and aggression. And I will not stay silent in the face of that evil.
The previous guest on Search for Das, the person who was just on before you, is Ron Bar-Yoshafat, who is an IDF Special Forces reservist. And my personal takeaway after that conversation was, never again will I allow for any petty concern that I have on my end in terms of speaking up, be it in a institution like Yale or Council on Foreign Relations or my day-to-day. Will I ever allow that to overcome the action that my intuition is telling me to take, allow that fear? Because I just spoke to someone who had his wedding planned, 10/7 happened, and he left to go into Gaza and was engaged in hand-to-hand combat. He put his life on the line, put his life on hold, and left his bride. And that is just a level of sacrifice that is multiples higher. I mean, in an entire different universe than what I'm thinking of. And so I appreciate you putting it into the context that you did, you framing it up in I believe a similar way. And I hope that everyone in this country, be it Jewish or not Jewish, because to your point, this is not about ultimately the Jewish people. This is the Western civilization, our tradition is what's at stake. And so I really appreciate when individuals who are so well-read in history like you frame it up that way, because that truly is what is on the line here. And I'm interested on that trip, which, well done. I saw you right before you went on that trip. So glad it was a success. I read some news stories about it. What were some of the takeaways that your fellow federal judges, who maybe are not as well versed in what's happening as you, what were their takeaways?
Oh, it was a transformational event for each and every one of them. The text messages, and actually in some cases, handwritten letters that I received from my colleagues around the country, I got goosebumps just reading them. And I reread them from time to time because they give me inspiration and strength. And it's not just people's words, almost all of them have now started going around the country themselves, giving their own speeches about what they learned on their trip to Israel and how misguided so much of the news coverage about what's going on really is. And so I'm just happy that I was a small part of having them get to go and see it for themselves. You know, and you can't go and not be inspired by these people. You know, on the one hand, you have a jihadist death cult, okay? On Columbia's campus, we make them out to be freedom fighters. There's nothing about freedom related to it. In the 47-minute video, the word freedom and Palestine and liberation, that never comes up. The most common word, some data scientist went through it, that appears in the video is Allah. Allah is all over the Allahu Akbar, while they behead and burn and mutilate people. And then the other two most common words are Jew and dog. And I think there was one dog in the video who gets shot. But other than that, dog is just a metonym for Jew. Now, this is how they see people who are not in the jihadi death cult. So that's on one side of the equation. On the other side of the equation, you have a vibrant Western liberal democracy in the mold of the United States. And I'll just tell you one story, but there are 100 stories like this. You know, we were at the scene of the Reim Music Festival massacre, and 364 young men and women, boys and girls, adolescents, were butchered there, and dozens were raped, and over 40 were taken hostage. Many of them are still being held in holes in Gaza even today. And they made an overwhelmingly powerful memorial there. They basically have built a small mound on the spot where each person was killed. And then from that mound, they have like a wooden stick. And on that stick, they've pasted a picture of the person and a little bit of a story of that person's life. Anyway, when the judges came off the bus, we were taken aback because all we could hear were the inconsolable shrieks and sobs of a mother who lay prostrate over the mound of her son. And honestly, it was like almost too much for one soul to handle. It was so overwhelming and all-consuming and painful. And her family members were trying to pull her off, and she would not be moved. And so I thought, you know, we got to move away from here. And at that moment, I thought I heard music. And I thought I was going crazy. But then I looked over towards the right, and I saw all these women together in a giant circle. And actually, I recognized the place where we were, because in the 47-minute video, which I mentioned earlier, at the end of the video, there's a scene where an Israeli soldier comes to the music festival massacre. And you can see it all through his body armor camera. And he comes to the bar, which is like a, you know, music festival bar. So it's a long rectangular area covered by a roof and surrounded by like a low hanging wall. And he comes to that bar and he's yelling out, you know, is anyone alive? Is anyone alive? And then he looks into the bar area, like over that low hanging wall. And, it's horrible. Like dozens of bodies of young kids, beautiful girls and young boys, bullet ridden, burned. It's like like scenes from the Holocaust, like those black and white movies of Jewish bodies just piled on top of each other, except in color, you know. And that's the spot where I was. I recognized the spot. And so I walked over there, and there were like 50 women there. And they were in a giant circle, and they were arm in arm, and they were singing Hatikva, the Israeli national anthem. And one of them said, please join us. And so I did. And that's when I noticed that the other judges were right behind me, and they started to intersperse themselves along the circle too. Everyone sobbing, no dry eyes in the circle, and everyone who knew it singing Hatikva. And I thought, what an unbelievable symbol of these people. On the place where more innocent Jews were murdered than in any other spot on the planet since 1945, these women had given up whatever they were doing that day on a Thursday in Tel Aviv, had gotten on a bus and driven all the way down to the south by Gaza to get together in a giant circle and sing, not of hatred or vengeance or vindictiveness, but of hope, because that's what Hatikva means, hope. Hope for each other, hope for their country, hope for the land for which they had fought for 2,000 years. And I just came away, all the judges came away with a sense of an incredible people deserving of our love, our admiration, and our support.
So glad that you organized that trip and that those individuals are now back on U.S. soil and sharing their experience. And that's what it will take. It's going to take an entire generation, I think, at least, to really get people to understand what exactly is at stake here and understand just how screwed up the narrative has gotten. Now, that we've got about 6 minutes here before we wrap up. And before we do, I want to talk about another area of law. An area of law that I think most Americans are not that well versed in, which is international law. And so could you help us understand exactly how that is influencing the war in Gaza, and specifically just in the past week, the ICC arrest warrants?
Yeah, the ICC arrest warrants are completely outrageous and, of course, speak to the double standard where you've got horrible actors all over the world. Don't get protested, don't get ICC warrants, and then you've got a genocidal terror regime that purposefully murders 1,200 innocent Jews, then embeds itself in its own civilian population in order to force the killing, accidental killing, but still killing, of Palestinian civilians. It's doubly evil in that way, and it gets treated with exactly the same search arrest warrant as the democratically elected prime minister of a Western democracy who is at war only to try to get back the hostages of his own population that were taken, and in a war that he didn't start, that his country didn't want, that was started by the enemy, who has embedded itself in terror tunnels underneath the ground next door. People want to liken this war to Vietnam and our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're not at all related in any salient way. Those wars are wars that we fought thousands of miles away from here. This is directly next door. When you're in Kfar Aza, you can look, turn around and look into Gaza. These people are right next door, and Hamas has promised that October 7th is just the beginning, that if they are not destroyed, they will commit October 7th against Israel over and over again until every last Jew is killed. And that's in their charter. The charter says that you must find every Jew, even under every rock and behind every tree, and kill them. That's what they have promised to do. That's what they represent. So no prime minister of Israel, whether he is Bibi Netanyahu or anyone else, left, right, or center, would ever stop before Hamas is destroyed. That means the end of Israel. Nor would any prime minister of Israel, left, right, or center, stop before the hostages are returned. I mean, that's suicide. Nor would any Western country do that. Nor imagine if the United States, if someone had come in and murdered 40,000 people in San Diego from Mexico, which is about what it would be per capita, and taken thousands hostage and was holding them in holes underneath Tijuana. Is there any doubt but that we would invade Mexico and start a massive war in Mexico, both to destroy that terror organization and to bring back our hostages? Of course, there's no dispute about that. But that, of course, doesn't absolve Israel of its obligation to abide by international law. And it has done that more than any other country involved in an urban warfare environment has ever done. You know, John Spencer, who's a major and the chair, former major in the U.S. Army and a chair of the Urban Warfare Institute at West Point, and Colonel Richard Kemp, who spent 20 or 30 years fighting urban wars in the British Army, have spoken extensively on the subject. They've compiled data that shows that the acceptable average militant to civilian kill ratio in urban warfare in the 20th and 21st centuries is 1 to 9, one militant for every 9 civilians killed. Think, for example, of World War II. We lost 2,100 people at Pearl Harbor. We and our allies killed millions of Germans and Japanese civilians. Is it nice? No. Would we have rather not have done that? Of course. But that was necessary to eradicate the evil of Japanese imperialism and German Nazism. Look at what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. We killed hundreds of thousands of people, especially in places like, for example, Mosul and Fallujah. Was it nice? Would we have preferred not to have been doing that? Of course we would have. But in Mosul, for example, in 2012, it was necessary to eradicate the evil of ISIS. And in Fallujah in 2004 and subsequent to that, 2007, during the surge, it was necessary to eradicate the evil of people like al-Zarqawi and al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so you look at the average acceptable limit of militant to civilian casualty rates in the context of urban warfare, it's 1 to 9. We, the United States and our allies in Iraq and Afghanistan, we set the gold standard, a ratio of 1 to 4.5, 1 to 5. And many scholars believe that no army would ever be able to replicate that again. In much more difficult scenarios, where Hamas's stated number one war aim is to have Palestinian civilians die in order to force the West to stop Israel's invasion so that they can survive to kill more Jews, where they've built terror tunnels 500 kilometers long and more sophisticated than any underground tunnel system the world has ever known, where they've fired, we saw videos and photos of them firing from Boy Scout rooms, little girls' bedrooms, hospitals, mosques, and schools. They built their command center underneath Al-Shifa Hospital and their electrical compound underneath an UNRWA facility. Just last week, one of my interns' first cousins was killed in Gaza by stepping on a booby trap in an elementary school, okay? A level of evil and war fighting that we could never begin to imagine here in the West. Even in those impossible scenarios, Israel has a kill rate in Gaza of 1 to 1 or 1 to 1.5, slashing by more than 75% the kill ratio even we, the United States, had accomplished in Iraq and Afghanistan. John Spencer has said that it may be the gold standard that no army will ever be able to meet in an urban warfare environment ever again. And yet somehow, despite that, despite how humanely Israel has taken steps to preserve innocent Palestinian lives in Gaza, it is Israel that is brought to the ICJ on false and preposterous claims of genocide. That's the double standard that I'm talking about. And when we talk about, for example, the protests, Bashar al-Assad murdered 500,000 of his own citizens in the war in Syria. We just learned that Putin has killed almost 3,000 babies in Ukraine. China has imprisoned almost 2 million Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps. Hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed in Darfur, in Sudan, and in the Congo, and in Myanmar, and civil wars all across the country. I haven't seen a single protest on any Ivy League campus about any of those things. But Israel has killed 15,000 militants and probably about 10,000 civilians, a number that pales in comparison to the kill ratios we've discussed in even Western wars, but certainly in all these other conflicts that I've just described for you. And yet it's Israel, preposterously enough, that gets protested, and not Syria or Sudan or the Congo or Myanmar or even Hamas. It's just too, the moral inversion is almost too pathetic to describe.
They're failing to think through this. And when I say they, I'm thinking of the average American that's sitting in media or on a college campus. They're failing to think like a judge. They're failing to weigh the evidence.
Let me just say one thing about that, because I think it's important. One thing I really have learned in my travels around the country speaking on this issue. The latest Harris-Harvard poll shows that 72% of Americans support Israel, to the point where they believe that Israel must destroy Hamas in Gaza, even if it means more civilian casualties among the Palestinian population. That is an unbelievable figure. 72% of Americans cannot agree on whether the COVID vaccine saved lives or causes cancer. 72% of Americans obviously can't agree on who should be president or how much government regulation or environmental protections there should be. But 72% of Americans do agree on how important it is to support Israel and how essential it is for Israel to defend itself, as it is rightfully obligated to do on behalf of its citizens under international law. So I wouldn't like to paint with too broad a brush. And I sometimes think that the media highlights these fringe groups on college campuses at the expense of actually showing what is much, I think, maybe less exciting and interesting, but probably more true, which is that the vast majority of the kids in these college campuses, and certainly the vast majority of people in this country, really just want to move about their lives, put food on the table, graduate if you're in college. And the conflict in Israel really doesn't have the level of salience for everyday Americans that I think the media wants us to believe that it does.
Well, I appreciate you pulling back and helping us understand exactly where most people in this country sit on this issue. And that gives hope, right? You mentioned Hatikva. Like, that, I think, is something that's so important for us to continue to kind of step back and understand that what we're seeing in headlines and some of the loudest voices don't represent the vast majority of us. And I mean, that gives me, you know, immense hope. And I, before we wrap up on this, because we'll go into a brief quick fire, any additional thoughts as you think about the incredible amount of time you've been speaking on this issue, thinking on this issue, anything else you want to put in there?
One thing I'll say is I have been all over the country, and after every speech, people will come up to me, sometimes dozens of them, sometimes more. And they want to tell me their stories. And they'll say, you know, I support Israel because, I mean, these are in churches around the country, for example, or in schools or in community centers. And they'll say, I support Israel because a Jewish doctor once saved my son, or a Jewish lawyer once took my case pro bono, or a Jewish landlord once knew that I couldn't pay the rent, and so he gave me 6 months for free. On and on and on. I've heard hundreds of stories like that. And so, you know, I take that to mean that we Jews and our allies, we have an obligation to be lights in the community. This is to your question to me earlier about standing up and being counted, to carry the torch and the flame that has been passed down to us for thousands of years. We do not have the right to relinquish it. Our ancestors, our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, going back to the Roman period, they fought tooth and nail to give us the right to live freely and to give us the privilege of having our own nation in our ancestral homeland in the land of Israel. And they are watching us. So I say to everyone I meet, be a light in the community. The way you conduct yourself in your home with your children and grandchildren, the way you conduct yourself at school with your teachers and other students, the way that you conduct yourself at work with your colleagues and opposing counsel, they are always watching us. And on everyone's shoulders is the burden of supporting the Jewish people in this existential moment, of propping up the one Jewish state in the world, and with it, along with it, of supporting, defending, and always extolling the virtues of Western civilization.
Well, thank you for those words. What an incredible charge. And thank you for seeing the situation with clear eyes and using words to describe exactly what's happening. So important. It's so valuable. So let's take it home with some quick fire here. Two sports at Columbia, baseball, football. You look back on it. What was the biggest win?
I pitched a game against Yale, actually. It was rainy all through the game and I was pitching well. And I used to wear glasses back then because I didn't want to wear my contacts and I hadn't had LASIK yet. And so they kept getting like wet with the rain, but somehow it was still getting people out. Then in the last inning, there were men on. And the sun came out, and I almost felt like it was just a very special, hard to describe moment, and got those three guys out, and just a memory I'll always have. And on the flip side of it, my last game, I pitched at West Point, I was pitching in the fifth inning or something, and there was a fifth or sixth inning, and there was a guy who had gotten out before with a straight change, left-handed hitter, and there was a man on base. I had been pitching well, and I had two strikes on him, so I threw the straight change thinking he'd just roll over it and ground out to the second baseman. But he did such a nice job. He stayed back. He just put his bat out and lifted it over the third baseman's head, and it had so much topspin it just bounced and then went all the way towards the dugout. And the guys were running around the bases, and he made it into second with a double. And the coach came out. It was the second to last game of the season, so he knew that would be it my senior year. And he said, took the ball and said, Roy, you've had a great career. And I was very emotional there, too. So I'll never forget that moment.
You have a golf foursome that you're putting together, and you have three people to choose from to join that, and they're your favorite legal scholars, be it current or past. Who are you inviting on that?
Well, I don't play golf, so I don't think that would be a fun, but maybe we're playing a doubles tennis match or something like that. I don't know. My favorite legal minds, I guess, to talk about with, I'd invite Oliver Wendell Holmes, just because I'd love to hear his stories about the war. I'd invite John Marshall because I'd love to hear his stories about fighting in the Revolutionary War. and during the founding, and probably I'd invite my colleague Bob Scola because he's really good at tennis, and I would want to beat those two guys.
I like it, thoughtful and strategic. Finally, what is Shabbat like? Shabbat like at your household on Friday nights?
We have Shabbat every Friday night. Usually, lots of people. My parents come. Sometimes my sister and her family come. Anyone who's visiting in town, which oftentimes is someone, and their family obviously is involved. My best friend from law school lives just a few houses down, so he and his family and their three kids are almost always over for Shabbat. So we've got a big group, the food is amazing. My mom will make avocado salad. My wife sometimes will make chicken marbella. And my dad and I and my friends will have some whiskey. I like smoky scotch. They generally prefer, things like Macallan and I guess you would say sweeter scotch. And then we sing Hatikva before Shabbat dinner with the kids lead us in song. And then we sing Shalom Aleichem. I will take the... And then my wife will say the blessing with the kids over the candles. I will take the Kiddush cup and say Kiddush. And then my sons will put their hands over the challah and make the blessing on the challah and then rip it apart like a great white shark eating a whale carcass in the ocean and get their grubby little hands all over it and then hand it out to everyone else. We dip the challah in honey. And we have lots of different kinds of honey that we take that part very seriously. And then finally, we get all the children together and we put our hands on their heads and we say the blessing for boys and for girls. Yevarechecha ve'yishmerecha. And then we sit down and eat.
Beautiful. What a wonderful way to mark the end of the week. And thank you, Judge Altman, for making the time. Thank you for your moral leadership. And thank you for being someone that we can all look up to in this important period of time.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak to me. It was an honor to be here.